The theme today is how science swims in the slipstream of ultimate questions. So the metaphor is a slipstream, and you can think of birds flying along in a V formation. The bird in front has to work hardest, and the next one gets an energetic advantage from the vortex created by the bird in front. And in this metaphor, the bird in front is ultimate questions, questions about meaning and purpose, and how can I know God? How can I do his will? And in the slipstream of those ultimate questions, the kind of curiosity about the material world that we would now call science flourishes. That's the theme. One of the gifts that God gives us is friendship. Roger Wagner and I have been thinking about these things together for about 20 years now. And so I thought the best way to start is to show you a bit of a movie that Roger and I made a couple of years ago, where Roger shows how he got interested in this topic.
I'm standing at the junction of two roads in the centre of Oxford. Down there are the spires and towers of the historic buildings at the heart of the university. To my right and behind me, the streets are lined with new laboratories. Laboratories are being built in universities all over the world. But it's easy to forget what a recent phenomenon this is. In 1860, a cousin of my grandfather, who was an undergraduate at the time, took a photograph from just about this spot. Here it is. It shows a new building that had just been put up. There's still scaffolding around the door. Now, in the 18th century, there had been an observatory built just down the road. But since then, this was pretty much the first purpose-built scientific construction that the university had ever commissioned. And if we walk a few yards down the road, we'll see that it's still there. When I was an undergraduate myself, about to leave the academic world and go off to art school, I became fascinated by this building. I was intrigued by the way it brought so many things together. As an artist, I've sometimes put new work in very old buildings. But I've also been interested in the collision between ancient stories and contemporary realities. This building, the Oxford University Museum, was full of such collisions. It was built in the style of a Rhenish medieval town hall, but constructed like a Victorian railway station, in the latest materials of steel and glass. It was a building dedicated to the accuracies of science, but gave artists and craftsmen a free hand to indulge their fantasy and imagination. This museum had interested me for all kinds of artistic reasons. But when I came back to Oxford after art school and started work, I began to get interested in the scientific history of this place. And what had prompted that interest was getting to know a scientist. Today, Andrew Briggs is the first professor of nanomaterials at Oxford University. He investigates the strange world of quantum effects that lie at the root of matter. When I first met him, he'd recently returned to science after taking a theology degree. For many years, my studio was on the top floor of the house in North Oxford, where the Briggs family lived. And during those years, we began a conversation about science that later turned into a book. For Andrew, as for me, a starting point had been an interest in a particular building.
That building is the Cavendish Laboratory, This is the original Cavendish Laboratory in Free School Lane in Cambridge. And that's the entrance, which has an inscription on the door. And the inscription was put there at the instigation of a man who, at the age of 48, was dying of cancer. And as a clergyman came to visit him in his house in Scroope Terrace, which was about 500 meters away, the clergyman discovered that this man's science was driven by a very, very deep Christian faith. And Roger will come back to that in a movie that he'll show towards the end of this afternoon. Now, here's a visual representation of this metaphor of the slipstream. These birds are very clever. They not only find the best position for the energetic advantage from the flapping of the wings in front, they even find the best phase with which to fly. Curiosity hasn't always been seen as a good thing. The original Greek and Latin words for curiosity originally meant being a busybody, you know, a wrong kind of sort of interference. But even in classical times, that achieved a positive connotation. So here's Seneca saying that man has been given a sublime head atop a flexible neck, the better to follow the stars. And he also goes on to say that scientific research will move from the realm of the visible to that of the intelligible. We'll come back to that with Roger Bacon in a moment. So from classical times, you can see how I'm struggling with the control system here. This is Miletus in what's now Western Turkey. And this was a place where in the 6th century BC, the idea was initiated of what they call the Arche, often translated as the divine first cause. And that change in the attitude to the divine cause of things that happen on earth released a whole new kind of curiosity about the material world. Because now, instead of thinking of the sun as Helios riding his chariot, or an earthquake as Poseidon shaking the ground, or a storm as at sea as Neptune getting angry, people were liberated to be curious about these material things for themselves and about causation within them. And after a pretty foolish political decision in Miletus, the Greek colony there fled back to Greece, and after some sort of further shenanigans, ended up settling in Athens. This is the theater of Dionysus, where the play The Clouds mocked Socrates' curiosity about both divine and material things. 20 years later, what had begun as a joke got more serious because Socrates was forced to commit suicide, essentially for disrupting the belief in the gods of the city. And his successors, Plato and Aristotle, again developed this theme of how does the curiosity about the material world sit within this bigger curiosity about ultimate questions. Fast forward 1,200 years, and this is some pictures of an amazing school of philosophy, probably dating to the 4th century AD, that was uncovered about 12 years ago or more, where there are 20 lecture theatres, generous-sized lecture theatres. I mean, each of them would easily take an audience this big. And this is where, in the 6th century AD, John Philoponus studied and taught and wrote. And John Philoponus is one of these great Christians in history who deserves to be much better known than he actually is. And fortunately, Pablo de Filippi is here, and in the next talk he'll tell us more about Philoponus. But this is where Philoponus did his thinking and working. And by the 16th century, his works were translated into Latin and were known here. Galileo was certainly read a great deal of Philoponus, and you can see much of Philoponus' ideas coming out in Galileo's work, and later on actually in Isaac Newton's work, because Philoponus really had the first glimpse of what we would now think of as the concept of momentum. Well, let's think of how some of these ideas have worked out here in Oxford. That's a picture of Oxford that actually Diana took from the plane one day when we were flying to France. The first chancellor, probably, of Oxford in the 13th century was this man, Robert Grosseteste. He later became bishop, Bishop of Lincoln. He was a person of deep Christian faith. He was well-read in Aristotle, but he cautioned against seeking needlessly to make Aristotle looked like a Christian, because he wasn't, but he commended learning from Aristotle's methodology, his way of seeking out the truth. Robert Grosseteste also did a lot of work on light, and his star pupil, Roger Bacon, actually did experiments and was the first person to observe that you never see a rainbow more than 42 degrees above the horizon. Well, whizzing on to the 17th century, and this is really an introduction to what Pete Jordan will be talking about today, we have another Bacon, Francis Bacon, setting out, as it were, an agenda for sort of what we now think of as science. And the frontispiece of his first book, I hope you can see this, I don't know if you can read from the back, but with absolutely astonishing foresight, Francis Bacon actually predicted accurately the two universities that would come top in the 2017 Times ranking of the universities of the world. Oxford, the pyramid on the left, and Cambridge, the pyramid on the right. But what I also want you to see, if you can, are these two orbs at the top here. And the left-hand one is the visible world, and the right-hand one is the intellectual world. And you see how they're shaking hands. You know, it could almost be the penultimate curiosity, this entanglement between the ultimate questions and the curiosity about the visible world. Well, soon after that, here in Oxford, one of the people who really changed the way people think was John Wilkins. He was warden of Wadham College. I cycled past his rooms as I on my way in today. And he created the experimental club in the 17th century that included such luminaries as Robert Boyle. Every school kid learns Boyle's law. Robert Hooke, every school kid learns Hooke's law. Edmund Halley, that's how we know that William the Conqueror invaded in 1066 because of Halley's comet in the Bayeux Tapestry. And the youngest member of the group was Christopher Wren, later better known for his architecture, but at the time doing experiments on the circulation of blood in the brain, specifically by injecting dogs with a sort of neuroactive drug and seeing how long it took the dog to respond to that and deducing from that that it wasn't diffusion but that blood must be being pumped around the brain. Within 8 years of the brouhaha in Italy about Galileo's work and this sort of argument that was, of course, an argument within the church, it wasn't science against the church, about the heliocentric view, within 8 years of that, John Wilkins published this book on cosmology, and you see the heroes on the front page. You've got Copernicus here, and Galileo there, and Kepler peeping over Galileo's shoulder. This is a plaque in the High Street on the right-hand side of that picture. Some of you may have come past it if you came down the High Street today. And there's Robert Boyle. So these were two of the members of that club. Robert Boyle, in his work on the spring and weight of air, what we now call Boyle's Law, did these amazing experiments where he really created the whole idea of the color analysis. So he showed in the right-hand thing there the columns of the experimental measurements, the difference, which was what he was interested in, and then in the right-hand column, column E, what the values should be according to his hypothesis. And you notice that there's no cheating. And so there are small differences, and he gives a careful discussion in the following pages of whether those differences are sufficient to falsify his hypothesis, or indeed whether, as he believed to be the case and argued to be the case, they're acceptable within the uncertainties of the experiment. But he also wrote about his Christian faith. So this is the title page and the start of chapter one of The Christian Virtuoso, showing that by being addicted to experimental philosophy, a man is rather assisted than indisposed to be a good Christian. Well, forward another two centuries to the 19th century, this is Henry Acland, who more than anyone else got science started in Oxford in the 19th century. And his vision was that the Museum of Natural History in Parkes Road should bring together his three passions of religion and science and art. Here is James O'Shea doing sculpting on one of the windows. It's to the left of the main entrance. A lot of people, when they go inside, especially with their small kids, just sort of concentrate on the dinosaurs in the Museum of Natural History. But really, they should look up and see these exquisite carvings, both in stone and in the metalwork, of flora and fauna. A few years ago, there was a debate in the museum lecture theater between Richard Dawkins and John Lennox. At one point, John Lennox turned to Richard Dawkins and asked if this building, the museum, had not had a religious motivation in its origin. Dawkins replied that it had not, and the debate continued, but they were both wrong. And had they looked up over their heads as they walked into the building, which all too few people do, they would have seen this carving. And next time you go there, have a look. It's a figure, it's got wings, so it's an angel, and in one hand, a dish containing three cells representing science, and in the other hand, a book representing the Bible and therefore faith. And this is utterly contemporary into the 21st century. Until recently, Rolf Hoyer was director general of the largest experiment in the world, CERN, at Geneva, where the Higgs boson was found. And over a period of 3 years, Rolf Hoyer and I, he was kind enough to let me have some input to this, organized a series of three 48-hour meetings, so two-day meetings, to discuss the interface between the kind of work that's done at CERN and its relevance to the Big Bang, and philosophy and religion. In 2014, the leading French language newspaper in Switzerland, Le Temps, invited Rolf Hoyer to be their guest editor of their Saturday special edition. And on the left there, you see an interview with him. And at his request, on the right-hand side, there's a full-page interview with me. And down at the bottom of that, you can just see his editorial comment on the interview with me. The interview, incidentally, has a sort of advance announcement of the penultimate curiosity. At that point, it was an aspiration. Now it's become a reality. This is what he said. The Director General of CERN, instead of opposing science and religion, it would be better to ask if science and religion are capable of respecting and accepting each other's point of view. In my eyes, it's completely possible. And in my experience, it's even enriching. And he was really talking from his own first-hand experience as manifested in those three conferences that we had. Well, I mentioned earlier that one of God's gifts to us is friendship. And for the last couple of years, three of us, Andrew Steen is here, Hans Halvorsen is at Princeton, have been discussing what keeps us seeking in our spiritual and intellectual lives. If you like, why are we still curious? Why do we remain curious? And what are we curious about? This is a picture of the three of us having a discourse about these topics. And after we'd taken the picture, Roger Wagner pointed out the similarity with the frontispiece of Galileo's discourses, where you have Aristotle, Ptolemy, and Copernicus with their heads in almost exactly the same positions. There's no intention of suggesting any one-to-one correspondence. And we've now put together a book which will be published by Oxford University Press next year called It Keeps Me Seeking. And here are some of the things that I would like to offer you as a sort of manifesto going forward for Christians in science to think about and discuss and develop. The first one is this, that God is a being to be known, not a hypothesis to be tested. The Templeton Prize this year was given to Alvin Plantinga, whose great contribution to philosophy has been that it's okay to start with God as basic. And some time ago in Wroclaw, of all places, I was having breakfast with Martin Rees. We were both at an Academia Europea conference, and neither of us was particularly interested in the first session, and so we lingered over breakfast. And Martin Rees was explaining to me that the reason that he didn't believe in God is because he's convinced that humans have not reached the end point of their evolution. They will continue to evolve, both biologically and in combination with machine learning and other kinds of artificial intelligence. And as that evolution continues, so our concepts of God will evolve and change. And he said that's why he can't really sort of have a fixed belief in God. And my response was, well, let's suppose that what you've said is true, which it may well be. He's got an extraordinary gift for seeing what's coming next in science. It would lead me to the opposite conclusion. And the reason is that God is not a postulate. He's a being to be known. And any relationship develops and should develop as time goes by. And if, as the years go by, our concepts of God become enriched through our experience, through our reflection, that is to be expected and that is to be welcomed. The second theme that we found ourselves thinking about is to set a high bar on what counts as a valid argument. And we wanted to liberate ourselves and others from wobbly arguments. You know, we were supposed to be voting for a strong and stable government, and we seem to have ended up with a weak and wobbly government. And we want to avoid weak and wobbly arguments on either side. So supposing you take the question of, is the universe a nice universe or a nasty universe? In other words, if we take the universe as it is it one that, well, you know, life as we have it now is sort of more or less inevitable, or at least very highly probable? Or is it one where it's extremely improbable? It's most unlikely that life should ever occur. And before too long, we may get some experimental data that may help to address that question. And, or observational data at least. And if the universe is very conducive to life, then you can say, well, how great, that's a wonderful argument for God, you see. It shows that God designed this universe so that life would arise. Or you can say, supposing it's a nasty universe where life is exceedingly improbable, it shows how miraculous God is to let life arise in this nasty universe. And the whole point we want to explain, it doesn't work either way. These are not good arguments, all right? There are much, much better ways of thinking. And indeed, the nature of the questions should change so that just as when a couple are courting, it is perfectly legitimate for them to ask, is this other person a suitable life mate for me? Perfectly legitimate question to ask. Once they're married, that ceases to be a legitimate question. It's too late to think about that. Now is the time to think about, how can I love this person? And in a similar way, the questions that it's appropriate for us to ask may change as our spiritual journey progresses. Third point is that uncertainty is okay. It's all right to live without certain answers, even to big questions. Actually, the rest of the world outside academia knows this perfectly well. The successful businessman, the successful businesswoman, they are the people who can make good decisions on the basis of incomplete information. And actually, we're doing that all our lives. And that applies to science and to faith. We don't need all the answers to all the questions before we can do anything. How can we know something without knowing everything? And I think that we can learn from the way that this ought to be nuanced in science. So on the one hand, science is an activity of open-minded inquiry. Those of us who are engaged in science research, we thrive on things that we don't know. We thrive on finding the boundaries of knowledge and being humble and being curious and being willing to change our minds and being open to surprises. But that is not the same as saying that there's nothing that we can be confident about as scientists. We can be pretty confident about the phase diagram of an aluminium alloy. And in fact, yesterday I was doing my instrument license renewal. Every time we get into an aeroplane, we're saying we're confident enough about metallurgy, literally, to trust our lives to these things. And I think there may be a lesson to be learned in faith from that. That is to say, as believers, we're constantly open to surprises. We're open to learn more about God. We're open to new ways of thinking. But that is not to say that there's nothing we're confident about at all. And this kind of question of where does the uncertainty lie, where does the confidence lie, is a matter of judgment, which actually improves with maturity, at least it should do. The final point, and I love this one, the final point is that we're allowed to open up the window that the natural world offers us. Let us, as Christians in science, celebrate that. The Hebrew scriptures in particular love observations about the material world that would nowadays fall under the purview of science. The Hebrew wisdom literature is full of it. Later on, Roger will show you a page or two from his translation of the book of some of the Psalms. A lovely place to start is Psalm 104. And this is a psalm which, even when it was first composed, would have been accessible to people outside the Jewish faith because of its resonance with the great hymn to Aten, possibly written by Akhenaten himself when he was pharaoh of Egypt in the 14th century BC. The mountains rose, the valleys sank down to the place that you appointed for them. You set a boundary that they might not pass, so that they might not again cover the earth. From your lofty abode, you water the mountains. The earth is satisfied with the fruit of your work. Praise the Lord, O my soul, praise the Lord. Well, Let me just return now in closing to our theme of the slipstream. And here are some more birds flying, with the birds behind benefiting from the slipstream of the birds in front. After we'd finished the book and OUP were printing it, Roger and I did a trip in a little airplane. We flew ourselves around some of the sites that we associate with significant advances in curiosity. And I'll just show you a little bit of the movie that we made. It starts early on in it. Roger is talking about this, which was found in the Blombos Caves in South Africa 100,000 years ago. And he loves it because there's evidence that people were mixing pigments to make artistic creations.
In the book that Andrew and I wrote together, we traced these motivations as far back through history as we could go. And now we're going on a journey to explore some of the key places in the long and extraordinary story that we discovered. I can remember that in the 1990s, what people called the human revolution only happened when Homo sapiens migrated from Africa to Europe and started making paintings.
And what changed that was the discovery in the Blombos Caves in South Africa of evidence that people were making symbolic markings 100,000 years ago.
I mean, in the newspapers they described it as the first artist studio, which I love, because they found these extraordinary abalone shells which were used for storing and actually mixing pigment.
Only last year in Indonesia they discovered evidence that when humans started to migrate from South Africa, one of the things they took with them was painting.
And the first European paintings were discovered just about the time we started writing this book.
Or at least thinking about it, yes.
Yeah. And that's where we're going now.
A la France!
Golf Papa Lima, I'm completing my run-up.
This journey will take us across the world and across time. It will begin in France with that discovery of a vast complex of prehistoric paintings. Paintings that the leader of the excavations is convinced were religiously motivated.
We know they have a religious motivation, first because people didn't live inside those caves.
But paintings which also show an astonishing attention to anatomical accuracy.
Doing it with such accuracy might have been vital because they were recreating them.
It was made perhaps 35,000 years ago, and it's an astonishing piece of work. The journey will take us on to a city on the coast of eastern Turkey.
Are somewhere inland, so I'm not sure we'll see them.
In 600 BC, Miletus was a coastal town, a wonderful centre for new thinking.
A city where, in the 6th century BC, a new idea of the divine coincided with a new kind of interest in the natural world. From there, we'll follow the route by which one man brought this idea to 5th century Athens.
Plato said he was the first person to work out how the shadowing of the moon was related to the sun.
Yeah, and he also said that the sun was not a god, but a fiery ball.
Which in 4th century Athens must have been a pretty controversial thing to say.
Yeah, I think he was probably quite a courageous chap, actually.
And visit the places where it provoked opposition and sparked a whole new way of thinking about the gods and studying the world. We will follow the path of these ideas to Alexandria in Egypt. Well, what happened in this great multicultural city when the philosophical religion of the Greeks and the revealed religion of the Jews and Christians came into contact? Well, the answer was riots. But we will also see how in a newly discovered philosophical school, where Christians and pagans studied together, a Christian philosopher who insisted that nothing should get in the way of truth anticipated one of Galileo's most famous observational experiments by almost exactly 1,000 years.
Two unequal weights dropped from a given height strike the ground at almost the same time.
Following this trail forward,
to the city of Pisa in the 16th century, we will discover how Galileo not only repeated that observation, but followed in that early Christian philosopher's footsteps in his conviction that pursuing truth as a Christian duty would reveal deep laws that govern the whole creation. Coming back to Oxford, we'll see how in the 17th century, religiously motivated natural philosophers sparked what we now call the scientific revolution. And finally, travelling first to Scotland and then to Cambridge, we will see how a 19th century scientist wrote down four equations which showed that the whole universe was filled with the surge of electromagnetic waves.
Their description of the fundamental gearing between space and time led directly to Einstein's theories, but they also provide the basis for all the electronic technologies that shape the modern world. The world we live in today begins with these equations.
And we will see how for that 19th century scientist, the discovery of those four equations, which revealed the deep unity of fundamental aspects of the universe, was carried along.
Human beings seem to reach out beyond the horizon of the visible world in order to try and make sense of it as a whole. You could describe it as ultimate curiosity. If then our curiosity about the world around us moves, as it were, in the slipstream of that ultimate curiosity, you could describe it as penultimate curiosity.
Andrew, we probably have got two or three minutes for questions, if you like to. And it was a very good advert for your book, which I believe might be on sale over there.
that's a belief that you can be confident
about. I can be confident about belief.
Degrees of confidence.
Anyway, we've probably got time for a couple of questions. So anybody like to start us off? Or comments? Oh, yeah, there's one there. Sorry, I can just...
I like enormously the metaphors and the models and so forth, and I'm interested to know, because I'm hearing different terms for the second one. So sometimes it's the natural world, and sometimes the visible world, and sometimes material world. And as you know, I'm interested in particularly teaching young children. And one of those would probably be enough. So which would be your favorite if you had to pick one, and why?
Well, we are very biased people, and we think that material science is the top discipline there is. So material world will do nicely.
Short and very biased. another question there. Thank you.
Yes, I had a traditional sort of Christian upbringing, New College School here in Oxford, and then Canon Woodard, I was sent away, and terribly interested in Christianity, and then even thought of taking holy orders, even. And then growing up, Navy, National Service, business, and that type of thing, things rather changed. And I think, although still attending church regularly, I'm rather disappointed that we can't... that Jesus actually then took on the role of God. If he'd been expressing many of the points that you made in your thing, interpreting it all, it would, you know, I'm just slightly disappointed. I mean...
Could we get to a question, because we're a bit short of time?
The question is, you know, why has he caused alarm in Christianity? Because... clearly, he wasn't God. Otherwise, he would have come back, and he would have defeated the Muslims. They wouldn't let them encroach on Christianity. And it's a sad thing that Christianity would be stronger today, in spite of Constantine and all the things.
We need to cut that. Yes. Quick response, Henry.
Well, it is absolutely extraordinary, and it is what differentiates the Christian faith from any other, that the, as it were, the invisible and the material world are united in Christ.
Thanks for that, Steve. I'll have one more question, and then we must move on.
I want to come back to the four themes that you introduced in Seeking. That very first statement, I wonder if it might even be better to think about removing the indefinite article and even thing from that statement, to begin to be able to talk about God as the ontogeny of being, as just simply God is, rather than a thing. Because one of the difficulties in talking about God nowadays is that people have difficult constructions of what we're talking about in their minds, and that might be a more inclusive and better way of beginning.
I love that approach, and I warm to it very much. In fact, we spend quite a bit of time in the book unpacking that. And actually, I'll give the last word in a moment to Andrew Steen, who has lovely ways of articulating this. But I think you're absolutely right that the word God has accumulated so much baggage that it's actually quite difficult to use the word in a way that's free of that baggage. And the sort of starting point that I would take is to say, when we're talking about God, we're basically talking about, you know, who Jesus was talking about as a basic starting point, with all that then follows from that. But Andrew, you expressed this so beautifully. How would you answer that?
I agree with the sentiment that was expressed in the question. So that, just to say, the first few paragraphs of the book very quickly say, well, a being, and yet that's not quite what we want to say, so focus your thought maybe primarily on to be known as the sort of prior thought. And then having said that, this issue about is God correctly thought of by us simply by the word just being, you know, or a being. And somehow, I think ultimately, I personally, and I think in the book, we don't want to, we're on a bit of an eye face. We don't want to descend into something in which God begins to fail to have a character or, you know, to be knowable as, you know, so we don't want to sort of fall into the way of speaking that might imply something not quite right either. So it's very hard. I think what I learned from this is that although we try to give little pithy summary statements, nevertheless, no little pithy statement altogether works. And I will think about your advice that maybe we rejig that one. And I will, don't let you know what I will think.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Thank you, Andrew, very much indeed.